Radio News. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New groups on the political scene are receiving huge attention this election season. Super PACs. These are organizations supporting a particular candidate but not affiliated with the campaign. Unlike other political fundraising entities, super PACs can raise unlimited money and spend it freely. So far, most of their cash has gone to television ads, airing in early states on the Republican presidential nomination calendar.
When Mitt Romney invented government-run health care, Romney advisors helped Barack Obama write the disastrous Obamacare. Now, desperate to save his failing
campaign. You'd think Newt Gingrich was Ronald Reagan's vice president.
I worked with President Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan played President Reagan.
Gingrich exaggerates, dropping Reagan's name 50 times. But in his diaries, Reagan mentioned Gingrich only once. Reagan criticized...
Back to work. The principled conservative who's never wavered in defense of the unborn. The only one with experience in the fight against radical Islam. Rick Santorum, the real conservative we can trust.
Fact. Active duty military personnel donate 3 times more money to Ron Paul than all the other GOP candidates combined. Fact. Lobbyists donate more money to Mitt Romney than all the other GOP candidates combined. Do you trust the troops?
Winning our future is responsible for the content of this message.
Paid for by Endorsed Liberty.
Restore our future is responsible for the content of this message.
Red, White, and Blue Fund is responsible for the content
Make
of this
Make Us Great
ad.
Again is responsible for the content of this message. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
Yesterday, some of the names and faces of individuals who finance these ads were released. And at this point in the election cycle, super PACs supporting the 4 major Republican candidates have spent a combined $24 million on TV ads. But that's just a warm-up for the fall election, when other groups supporting a variety of candidates and causes will join in, spending hundreds of millions of dollars on advertising and traditional campaign activities like phone banks and get-out-the-vote drives. Today in The Exchange, the supersizing of campaign fundraising through super PACs. We want to hear from you. How do you view super PACs and the role they're playing? Are they something to worry about, or are they a source of political speech and even useful voter information? Give us a call, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. With me in studio is John Rao, founder and CEO of Americans for Campaign Reform, a bipartisan nonprofit working for voluntary public funding of federal elections. And John Rao, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Laura, great to be here.
Also with us in D.C., John Samples, director of the Center for Representative Government at the Cato Institute, author of The Struggle to Limit Government. And John Samples, welcome back. Good to have you, too.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Well, gentlemen, before we get on to all the arguments surrounding super PACs, John Samples, just to you first, please. We've heard for a long time about PACs, political action committees. What's the difference between a regular PAC and a super PAC?
Well, the regular PAC was created by federal campaign finance law in the early 1970s to provide a way for to put together and raise money and to give to candidates. Now, the regular PACs for that 40-year period are limited both in the contribution size they can accept and in the contributions they make. And they typically pass the money. They're an intermediary. They pass money from their contributors to the make contributions to candidates. And they tend to be thought of as in the sort of inside game here as the kind of insiders. They are lobbyists and sort of Washington establishment types are going to be involved in those. The super PAC is a result of the biggest Supreme Court case you never heard of, which was SpeechNow versus Federal Election Commission. And in this case, basically, the idea of Citizens United was applied, that the people who are not affiliated with campaigns or the parties can raise money and spend as much as they want to because there's no corruption rationale, which is the basis of regulating this kind of funding in American politics. And so basically the super PACs, or independent expenditure committees in their technical term, have basically existed for about a year or so because of the SpeechNow decision. And we've seen them more in, we're going to see them more in this campaign than in past ones.
Well, and John Rowdy, you super PACs are often said to have been born to the Supreme Court Citizens United ruling, but John Samples just said there's a related case that we need to know about, Speech Now. Just real broadly, John Rowe, how did these rulings change the rules of the road?
Oh, they changed it quite dramatically. As John implied, the super PACs can now spend unlimited money and can raise any amount they wish that a donor wants to give them. Those super PACs that we're seeing today can attack or support a candidate, somewhat contrary to the that part of McCain-Feingold that Citizens United decision overturned. But there's one other important way to understand super PACs. They cannot coordinate with the candidate. And if you're a candidate, it seems to me you kind of like to put your own message out there. And I recall when I ran against Judd Gregg, Laura, in 1992, a couple of years ago, I was advised one night that I was on television and we hadn't put our ads up. It was the League of Conservation Voters putting out my message. Now, I was delighted to have their support. But I believe one of the problems with super PACs is that it's not the candidate's message, and that's what the voters are going to decide on.
Well, and I want to ask you about that in a little bit, because I did see something about some campaigns. Mostly they love the super PACs because they help them with the television advertising. But there is some grumbling on campaigns about coordinating that message. But to something that John Rouse said, John Samples, officially, on paper, super PACs cannot coordinate with the campaign. But, you know, a lot of people sort of snicker. I mean, people running these super PACs, you know, worked for the campaign yesterday or last week.
Well, if I could just make one additional point about the earlier, just to give us some context here. It is true that there's going to be large contributions this time around. But, in fact, you know, throughout over the last decade and more, we've seen, I mean, in the 2004 campaign, in a similar but, you know, different, quite legally, George Soros and two friends gave $75 million between them to the Kerry campaign. We may well not see anything from three people of that level. And then if you go back before that, you did have a number of $1 million and above contributions to soft money to the party committees. So this is, it is a different vehicle. And yes, the important thing is the legal change, but there is still that. And as to the larger question about independence, yeah, I think this is, I mean, one of the things that's always been true about campaign finance is you've got a lot of smart people working in it. Everyone recognizes that, and they try to adapt to the rules and the circumstances as best as possible. I think this is one adaptation to deal with exactly the thing John was talking about, which is that because there are coordination rules, the coordination rules, that is, you can't, what it means, coordination, it means essentially the candidate and his staff cannot control this organization. They can't communicate with them. So this is a way of trying to at least, what the candidate fears above all is that these groups will do something that does harm to the campaign because they have poor judgment, they're not coordinated or whatever. I mean, in other words, they do things that harm the campaign by they're working against the message, they're cutting against the message, and so on. So this is a way of dealing with that. It's a, you know, legally they're certainly going to meet that. The way of dealing with it may, there's already proposals that nobody who ever worked for a candidate can have one of these candidate supporting ads. The other thing, you know, I mean, the real question to me seems to be, if you're not going to have something that is independent and described as an independent entity, not coordinated under Citizens United, you're essentially, Congress is going to have plenary power over campaign funding, and that seems to me to be a really bad idea. That the politics is not going to protect people's ability to be critical of Congress, which congressmen, I mean, a lot of this, we go on, and John and I, you know, go on about fundamental values and things like that. But a lot of this stuff is members of Congress just and others don't like being criticized in ways they feel are unfair. And I sort of sympathize with that, but that's part of what
goes with the territory. Let me invite our listeners to join us and then get into some of those fundamental values that you mentioned, John Samples. Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in the exchange, we're learning more about super PACs that have gotten a lot of attention this election cycle. And we want to hear from you. How do you view super PACs and the role they've been playing in the Republican nomination so far, the role they may play in the general election? Do you think there's something to worry about, or do you think that they're a source of political free speech, even useful voter information? Give us a call, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And John Rao, I can see you want to jump in. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, in terms of understanding super PACs, I think we have to put on the table that Citizens United said corporations and unions can use their treasuries to spend any amount they wish for or against a candidate. They really, in my view, said corporations are, to some extent, have the same First Amendment rights as people. This is what Justin Stevens wrote in his dissent in this case. In the context of election to public office, the distinction between corporate and human speakers is significant. Although corporations make enormous contributions to our society, corporations are not actually members of it. So one of the aspects of the Citizens United decision that I disagree with is giving First Amendment rights to corporations, which in my view, we citizens elect a Congress and a president, and they determine the rights of a corporate. Corporations are instruments of we people, in my view.
Let me ask you a quick question about that, John Rao. And then, John Samples, I know you want to have a response. Okay, so if you're saying corporations are not people, they shouldn't be given the same free speech rights. What about the wealthy couple? I can't remember their names. The guy is a Las Vegas gambling mogul, and he's been donating a lot to Newt Gingrich's super PAC. So he's not a corporation. He's just a fabulously wealthy individual. Does he have free speech rights?
He happens to be a citizen of our country, and his name is Sheldon Adelson. And yes, Sheldon can give any amount of money he wants. He can spend independently any amount of money that he wishes.
In favor of Newt Gingrich.
But there's a difference, Laura. He's a citizen.
So that's okay. It's not the amounts you're worried
about.
Whether
it's okay or not is academic. It's the law of the land, and I do not think it'll be changed.
All right. We will talk more after a short break for sure. Lots more to dig into, gentlemen. And we'll take your calls to 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll be right back.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from UR members and from New England College School of Graduate and Professional Studies, launching the new MBA in healthcare, offered on-site and online. Information at nec.edu. And Mark Nygold Smith's at 2 Capitol Plaza in Concord, where most ring resizing is completed in-house in 7 to 10 days, and express service is available at knipegold.com. More on the super influence of super PACs on the exchange on NHPR than a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, Catholics, contraception, and the new healthcare law. New Hampshire weather today, mostly cloudy statewide, with some breaks of sunshine across parts of southern New Hampshire. Highs today near 30 in the north country, ranging to 40 in southern parts. Then tonight, mostly cloudy and cold, lows near zero north of the White Mountains, ranging to 15 to 20 degrees in central and southern parts of the state. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a look at super PACs. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477 or send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org. Now that you've heard a little bit about what super PACs are and how they operate, what's your opinion of super PACs and the role they're playing in our elections process? 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Or send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook. We hope you'll go to our page, join the conversation there. John Samples, before we go to our listeners, I did want to ask you about what John Rao mentioned just before the break. In his Citizens United dissent, Justice Stevens said corporations are not people. They don't have the same free speech rights. I wonder what you think.
Well, in the majority opinion, Justice Kennedy pointed out that, you know, if you look at the First Amendment, well, if you look at the Constitution as a whole, there's a discussion of citizens are mentioned, the 14th Amendment, for example. Persons are mentioned, for example, in the part empowering the Congress to have a census. In the First Amendment, it says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. and then on to the rest of the protections. It doesn't mention people. It doesn't mention natural persons. It doesn't. It just says the focus is on speech and abridging the freedom of speech, and it doesn't ascribe that right only to natural persons. The other thing I would say, I think it's misleading, in my view, to talk about this not being about people. And remember, this is about the corporate form, which embraces both businesses, trade unions and their political entities, and also a number of interest groups. In all of these cases, including businesses, which I think is what people mostly fear and decry here, is you are talking about people. You're talking about people who are in a legal form, in a business formation. And they have a common interest, and they have a management that makes decisions about this in terms of politics. Now, that said, I think we should be aware of the circumstances here, which I think these super PACs of individuals are going to be the big issue for some time, because remember there was a big example early on in which the Target Corporation gave some money to a political campaign that was then in turn linked to an anti-gay marriage initiative, and which was then led to a giant explosion of bad publicity for the Target Corporation. These are conservative political organizations in the sense that they are unwilling to risk the brand by getting involved in divisive, nasty political fights, unless they have something fundamental at stake. And I think, generally speaking, they're going to be pretty wary of doing that.
Let's invite our listeners again to join us. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And first up is Olivia in Franklin. Go ahead, Olivia. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question for the panel is that in the Citizens United decision, the Supreme Court upheld disclosure, that these groups must tell us who's speaking, and they're not allowed anonymous speech. Do you believe that New Hampshire should update our laws to define PACs and define super PACs and require them to disclose?
Well, it's a great question, Olivia. Not just New Hampshire, but also this disclosure issue has come up just this week because some of the individuals behind these super PACs were disclosed this week. John Rao, you first, please.
Oh, I think, Olivia, disclosure is deeply important, and New Hampshire should do that. So should the Congress and the President. There was a disclosure bill that Senator Schumer, Congressman Van Hollen, put in a little over a year ago. I thought it was somewhat partisan, so we were not supportive of that. But disclosure is vital. There are some new efforts underway on both sides of the aisle in the Congress today for disclosure legislation, and I think you're right. It's vital. Now, let's be clear. There is disclosure required of the super PACs in a non-election year every 6 months. In an election year, I think it's monthly. But a lot of the money has yet to be disclosed because many of them have nonprofit organizations, 501c4s, and those C4s do not have to disclose at all. So we are in the dark, as the New York Times so clearly points out this morning, about what has been donated and spent by those C4s. In understanding the C4s, know that half of the funds that they spend must be used for a good social purpose, and how that all plays out isn't clear. But bottom line, let's go to the guts of your question. Yes, disclosure is vital. Does it solve the problem? No. Is it important?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, John Samples, what do you think? Disclosure.
Well, one point I would make about the decision is they said that it is permitted. That is, as the law from Buckley right. versus Vallejo on, it's been permitted. That doesn't mean that it already exists. It means Congress can pass a disclosure law if they want to, or I guess a state legislature could too. And as John mentioned, and by the way, you see why I admire John and his organization's integrity. That's the only person I've heard from the reform side mention that the Disclose Act was one of the most partisan pieces of legislation I've ever seen, which is saying something, because it was right after Citizens United, and it was kind of there was a fear that they were going to lose Congress, and so they could have had disclosure of a normal kind, I think, if they had been a little less frightened and a little more willing. I think you may get it just as a positive point because Republicans are said to be the free speech people. They get members of Congress they're political creatures, you know, and it's a fight in some ways for them. And they don't like the reason people in politics want disclosure is not the reason that's given in the court decisions. It's because they want to know who's opposing them. And then when they're opposed...
Let me ask you a question about disclosure, if I could. So, you know, Olivia was asking both about disclosure here in the state level and federally. And this week, there was a lot of news surrounding the disclosure of some of the donors to these super PACs. But here's what the New York Times said, John Samples, and I want your opinion. It says, the full scope of giving is impossible to ascertain from the federal campaign filings. Much of the money raised by the leading Republican and Democratic independent groups went into affiliated nonprofit organizations that are more restricted in how they spend the money but do not have to disclose their donors. So it seems like you can hide it if you want to, you know?
Well, I mean, the sort of the underlying assumption here, I would say, about this is, you know, there's a nefarious reason. And the word secret is in every campaign finance editorial of the New York Times because people, you know, they can imagine, well, what's going on here? And what's going on is if we didn't know about Sheldon Adelson, we would know that there's a bunch of money that Gingrich has, and he used it to attack Romney about Romney's business career. We know that, and that's, in some sense, that's the important thing, unless you believe that there's sort of machinations in the back going on. And in any case, you know, I mean, disclosing people's political activities, there is always the danger that they implicitly or mostly implicitly, not explicitly, face the threat of retaliation from members of the government. Now, whether that is a cost, there's been, you know, the one thing I would mention here, Laura, is very interesting, those commercials that you had at the first, because Ron Paul's commercial actually was the only one I've ever heard in my life that shows you the legal justification for disclosing super PAC donations, which is, remember, the Ron Paul commercial says, look, I've got a bunch of donations from the troops, and Romney or whomever, Gingrich, gets donations from the lobbyists. That they're making those kinds of choices. Who do you trust the most?
Well, and
that's actually the disclosure justification.
And you've written, John Samples, and I want to ask John Rao about this. John Samples has written, that, you know, that's useful information. So maybe these super PACs are helping us out as voters.
I'm not going to go quite that far, but in terms of disclosure, I just want you to know that there are disclosure bills that are being worked on now. We're involved with that. And those disclosure bills need to deal with what you read from the New York Times, that these nonprofits have to disclose also, as well as the super PACs. So the legislation, I think John's right. I think we could see a bipartisan bill go through as long as it's clean and nonpartisan.
Well, thanks, Olivia, for that call. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And gentlemen, here's an email from Ruth and Keene, kind of related to what Olivia was saying. She says, I would like to know how the guests feel about outside money in races for seats in the New Hampshire legislature. I realize that much of today's commentary is about federal elections, but Ruth says it's becoming obvious to many people that with the advent of super PACs, money has poured into New Hampshire and other states from outside sources. The negativity and destructiveness of what we read and hear are becoming distracting from the issues and knowing the candidates' real positions from past records. Ruth says, most importantly, good candidates without such money to underwrite the costs of competing are discouraged from running. A couple thoughts there, and I think, John Rao, I'd like you to address what she says about New Hampshire, and then maybe John Samples, this issue that does come up, good candidates without money to underwrite the cost of campaigning are discouraged. But John Rao, you first, go ahead on what may be happening here in New Hampshire.
Well, I think the concerns that we have regarding the federal system apply clearly, Ruth, to the New Hampshire system. But in terms of competing, let me be very clear here. A candidate running for high office needs to have sufficient funds so that the voters can understand that candidate, his or her values and perspectives, so that candidate can answer attacks. But that candidate doesn't have to have the most money, just enough money so that the voters can size him up and make their choice. Look at South Carolina, where Gingrich won in a landslide. And who spent the most? Romney. But in New obviously, Gingrich had enough. That applies to New Hampshire, that concept, as well as to federal elections. I also want to point out one other thing as we talk about super PACs and Citizens United. Had Sandra Day O'Connor not left the bench and replaced by Justice Kennedy, I suggest that Sandra Day O'Connor, who supported McCain-Feingold being constitutional, that she would have voted otherwise on the Citizens United and we would not have the 5-4 decision. It would have gone 4-5 the other way.
What do you think about the second part of Ruth's email, John Samples, that good candidates without such money to underwrite the cost of competing are discouraged from running?
A couple of things. I think candidates that are, you know, have, even for the presidential office, that have the kind of ability that can tell a story about to people, to donors, that or have the ability to put together an organization to raise money from relatively small donors, can run for office. They have to have that ability. They have to have the ideas and the attractiveness. And so you do see that Obama is a case, or Clinton is a case here. And traditionally, you can raise quite a bit of money from relatively small donors. The second thing I would say, though, is the alternative, those candidates are going to have some money in some ways. The alternatives are if you don't have a private system, you're going to have some kind of public financing system of subsidies, which means you're going to have some kind of rules for selecting these candidates to begin with. And also you're going to get your hands on the money elsewhere. The money is for these campaigns is going to be in private hands initially to begin with. And so it's going to be a tax system, or it's going to be a system where people voluntarily give the money to people.
So, John Samples, you're not worried about, you know, people who don't have a big super PAC behind them being shut out of the process because they don't have those resources?
Well, at this point, I mean, the super PACs are, there's a kind of bias issue, I think. We've gone through with this in the past, which is stuff is happening. There was a big super PAC issue in Florida with lots of spending. But so far, often in the past, you know, during the soft money era where people could give large donations to parties, there was a lot of excitement and concern about that. And then people got around at the end of the day looking back at it, and it was like 12-15% of the total. So I guess that kind of history leads me to say, let's not rush to judgment on these issues.
Let's take another call. This is Lee in Lebanon. Hi, Lee. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning, Laura. This is leading right back into on the federal level. What has happened to the $3 that we could check off on our income tax to be donated to the presidential elections? Seems to me that in the final campaign, at least, there should be no need for any outside money, and the super PAC should be completely cut out if we can deal with the free speech part of it. Would appreciate whatever thoughts you have on that.
Yeah, thanks. Lee, it's a good question. John Rao, people often ask about that.
The percentage of the taxpayers who are checking off the $3, Lee, has declined dramatically. It was close to 30% at the outset. I think it's a little under 10% now. And I don't think the people who are not checking it off are wrong. The system is broken. Today, it's $50 million max for a presidential candidate in the primary, $84 million in the general. The amounts are not enough. We're working on legislation to get the amounts to appropriate levels. But I want to go back to just one thing that Ruth said, because I think she's dead right.
This is Ruth and Keene, who emailed
Ruth
earlier.
Ruth and Keene, dead right. I think the current system of private financing of these elections completely is discouraging quality candidates for running. And it's one of the most important reasons to go to a voluntary public funding system so that we can search across this country for the finest leaders that we can find to put into high office. Let's remember, we only select 536 people to meet our challenges. If they don't meet our challenges, you know what happens to our challenges? They don't get met. 536 people. Yet we put up this huge barrier of raising this amount of money. And I think Ruth's point about how it discourages people from running is a fundamental reason to change the system to voluntary public funding.
Well, and John Rao, to you, you know, John Samples mentioned a couple minutes ago past attention, past hype about soft money and PACs and other vehicles of campaign funding. And, you know, there are some people who say, look, wealthy individuals have always donated, unions have always donated, have always had a say, that these super PACs are just the latest extension of a trend that's been going on for years. So maybe we don't need to get all hot under the collar about that.
I think John is quite right there. And when we say public funding, we're advocating for voluntary public funding. Rich folks can spend what they wish independently, okay, that contribute to the candidates based on the law at the time. We're not trying to block the private money. We're just saying let's have a voluntary public funding system where the citizens decide, John, who gets that money. In the Durbin bill, the Fair Elections Now bill, the candidates who get the public funding money are first required to raise small checks from citizens and those checks that get matched. So the decision who gets the funding comes from the will of the people, not the government.
Well, and thanks for that call, Lee. Our number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And gentlemen, here's an email from Andrew who says, your guests have described recent legislation that attempts to address this issue as being partisan. He asks a great question, and John Samples, I'll throw it to you. He says, what made the bills partisan?
Well, it was clearly, first of all, the Democratic Party wrote it and went looking for Republican votes and couldn't find it. It was really the nature of the bill. It had extraordinary disclosure requirements. All the stuff was within, within on the disclosure side within Supreme Court ideas, but it also essentially redefined a large number of corporations as foreign corporations, which was clearly designed to reinstate Citizens United without overturning or trying to overturn the decision. Maybe they went into it thinking we'll go for the broke and then compromise it back, but it was so partisan that it actually scared everyone away and raised questions about, the disclosure. I mean, the disclosure requirements in it, as I recall, when it initially started, it took, everybody that was four or five people had to appear and their names had to appear. It took up a third of the time in one thing or another. It was not a good faith effort and Citizens United came 3 days after Scott Brown won the Massachusetts Senate race. So it was in a political cauldron that led to sort of a 4 or 5 months of hysteria, and then, of course, the 2010 results. When I say disclosure will happen, John says he thinks it'll be bipartisan. I do, too. I'm a little less sanguine about the motivations. I think Republicans who are in swing districts are going to attract some considerable criticism from these some of these groups, and they're going to join together to want disclosure because, again, they want to try to discourage that kind of spending.
Well, it's interesting, and you mentioned Scott Brown. Now the U.S. Senate contest in Massachusetts between Scott Brown and Democrat Elizabeth Warren, they've made an agreement to temper the effects of super PACs. So I want to ask both of you about that after a short break, and we'll take your calls to 1-800-892-6477.
By now, you know you can donate your old car to NHPR. And you know how easy we make it by filling out the paperwork for you, picking up the car, and auctioning it off. But what you may not realize is that we accept more than just cars. You can donate anything to our vehicle donation program, from a snowmobile to an RV to a boat. Find out more at NHPR.org or give us a call and get the process started at 1-877-393-NHPR.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Waste Management. Each person generates 4.5 pounds of waste each day, which is fuel to create renewable energy. See how waste to energy works at thinkgreen.com. And Vineyard Brands, importers of Wars Ports of Portugal, including Warrior and Otima 10-year-old Tawny Port. Information on the web at vineyardbrands.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, the author of a new book, The Accordion Family, examines the dramatic rise in young adults living with mom and dad. Email us your questions to exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, we're taking a closer look at super PACs and their role in this election year. How do you view these organizations? Are they providing important political speech and voter information? Or are you worried about the role they might play in influencing the outcome of elections? Our number 1-800-892-6477, the email exchange@nhpr.org. And John Samples, John Rao, let's go back to our callers now. Claire's joining us from Hollis. Hi, Claire. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just want to say I am so discouraged and I am so disappointed in what's happening, because big money has always played a part, but never to the extent that it is right now. And when I hear John Rouse, the other John, mention that candidates who have something to say and can raise money, yada, yada, I just don't believe what he is saying is true, because you can have candidates that work their way up through state into, regional positions. They don't have money, and there is no way that they're ever going to be able to raise the amount now needed. And I think there needs to be a way to rein in and to bring us back to some kind of logical, conclusion what to do about this. And I think John Rouse's organization is an important organization. I'm a strong Democrat. Buddy Romer was a strong Republican. He was the one person who would not take more than $100 for each of his contributors. And he could never make the debate because he couldn't raise the amount of money needed, because he didn't want to. He only took $100. He was like the most pure candidate. And yet, except for MSNBC, no one gave him any time to express himself. And if people had had a chance to listen to him, he had a wonderful message. He's a brilliant man.
Well, and Claire, yeah, and relating some of the, or echoing some of the comments from our emailer, Ruth. And Buddy Romer was on our program, too. I just want to make sure that you know that. But let's talk about that. And I think, John Rao, to you first, you know, Buddy Romer limited the amount of campaign contributions he would take to $100, and he didn't do so well.
Well, I agree with Claire that Buddy's message was vitally important. We've spent a lot of time together. And I applaud what Buddy has done, with one exception. By limiting the contributions to $100, Buddy didn't have enough money to get known. And if you don't get known, you're not going to move at all in the polls. So he had to get to 5% in the polls to get in the Republican debates. And I think if Buddy had gotten in the debates, he would have gotten his message out in a really strong way.
So should he have limited his donations to 200 or 500?
I can't give you the exact amount, but, you know, I think he had to limit it to far higher than $100. He had to get known. If you don't get known, you're not going to move in the polls. But Buddy's done a terrific job.
Well, you did this too, right, when you ran in the
90s? Yeah, and I made the mistake that Buddy made.
You think it was a mistake to do what you did, limit contributions to your campaign?
Very frankly, in that particular campaign, I may have raised a bit more with a $100 limit than I would have otherwise, because I was running against a former congressman. Mm-hmm. But did I have enough money to win that election? No, you don't have to have the most, but you better have enough.
Well, and can you, John Samples, address the emotion behind Claire's call? You know, she says, look, you know, this is crazy. It's too much money. We need to rein it in.
Well, a couple of things. Let me address first the issue that goes back a little bit, which is, it seems to me this idea that a small number of contributors going into public financing or just limiting yourself to $100 is based on the idea that you're going to get better candidates from these small groups of people, or, as she said, more pure candidates, because they represent the people. But again, even on the public financing bill that was before Congress, that was going to be a relatively small percentage of the people living in a House district or a state. They're going to be highly active political people. They're going to be unrepresentative. The other side of it, of course, I think, is what powers a lot of campaign finance rhetoric, which is people with larger contributions are going to be selfish or self-interested or just bad, give you bad candidates. I think the motivations are a lot more mixed. Again, I come back to George Soros, who gave $25 million on one issue, which was the war. Sheldon Adelson apparently is a single issue giver too. A lot of these people are going to be giving not in a self-interested way, but perhaps in a single issue way. Now, the other question she had was about, could you repeat it? I'm sorry.
Well, it was the broader idea that, you know, big money has gotten out of control. Oh. It's too much. We need to rein it in.
Oh, well, you know, it still remains true. It will remain true, I guess, that there will be a lot of $100, $200, $300 contributions this fall. But I think the other thing we have to keep in mind here that John sort of alludes to is that you need money to run these things, but more spending, more money, is a good idea, because it's highly competitive. It leads to competition, but it also leads to more information being offered. And, you know, it has been shown in at least one case that high-spending competitive races are really good for voters because and critical ones, ones where these so-called negative ads are run, are good for voters because voters don't know a lot about candidates. They particularly don't know a lot even about their own officials serving. And these kind of high-spending competitions do, in fact, increase it. And the finding has been, actually, that people who have less knowledge benefit more going in. They benefit more from a high-spending campaign than
you know,
those.
Actually, yeah, I've seen you write that, John, as some of the articles that you've written. Mm-hmm. And before I ask you guys a couple more questions and take an email, John Rowe, what about that? High spending leads to more interest, to more knowledge, to more participation by voters.
We're not suggesting that political money is bad. We're suggesting that the source of that money is a serious problem with the system. When you see Jeffrey Katzenberg give $2 million to Obama's super PAC, and you see Sheldon Adelson, as John points out, put $10 million into Gingrich, if one of them happens to be in the White House, one of them is, by the way, I think they have an influence that's inappropriate. But with voluntary public funding, that becomes academic. We have it in three states now, Maine, Connecticut, and Arizona. And in all three states, approximately 75 to 80% of the candidates who run use public funding and the same amount are elected. And you talk to the legislators in those states, and guess what? When those who have given big money privately to other candidates come to talk to them, they talk about the issues. The money has no influence. But let me point out here that with voluntary public funding, if the big money is not needed by those candidates, they're going to be free to lead on their values, use your judgment. And I think it's a fundamental reason for public funding.
Well, since you mentioned what's happening in various states, let me ask both of you about what's happening in Massachusetts. Here's an editorial from the LA Times. Okay, so they're giving their opinion here, talking about the agreement between Republican Senator Scott Brown, the incumbent, and Democratic challenger Elizabeth Warren. Here's what the LA Times says. Under their agreement, if an independent group such as a super PAC buys a TV ad backing one of the candidates, that candidate will donate an amount equal to the half of the cost of the ad to the charity of the opponent's choice. Thus, an ad placed independently by a super PAC could end up harming as well as helping its pick. LA Times says, to some, this pact is a flagrant violation of the free speech rights of those individuals who contribute to super PACs. The Times says, we think it's a sensible way of reducing the corrosive influence that independent political groups are having on our democracy in the wake of the what they call flawed Citizens United decision in 2010. I wonder what you think, John Samples, of this interesting, somebody called it a political pinky swear in the Bay State.
Well, I don't think I can agree that it's a violation of free speech rights, because only keep in mind the government, it's a free speech is a protection against government, Congress in particular, and these two people have for now agreed to this and would follow through. I don't see any the government forcing anyone to do anything. I do suspect this was tried in campaign finance, I should say, everything that's old is new, and it's sort of this was tried in the Senate race in New York and in 2000, Hillary Clinton's race. And as I recall, it tended to break down. It was about soft money over time. And I think this race is one of the big races. It's a very symbolic race because of Elizabeth Warren and what she stands for and what Scott Brown stands for. I don't think there's going to be a lot of interest, and it's going to be probably a close race. So I suspect that this is sort of thing that happens early on, but they both will want to win. Politicians want to win. Parties want to win this one. And the groups want to win it. So I don't think it'll hold up over time.
What do you think, John Rowe? Yeah.
I applaud both of them. I'm not saying it's the ultimate answer because it's voluntary, and I think we have to deal with the problems of private financing legislatively. But I applaud the two of them for doing it.
Well, and what do you think about John Samples' prediction that it will break down over time? We've seen this before. You know, candidates start off saying, yes, I'm going to be squeaky clean. But in the end, you know, if you want to get your initiatives through, you got to win.
I think it may break down. I'll be sorry if it does. It breaks down. It says something about those who break it down. But at this point, let's be optimistic. I think they've made a good point.
Well, here's an email from Wayne who says, at the end of the day, Citizens United serves to empower lobbyists in Washington, creates a powerful retaliatory tool for corporations and unions to wield against elected officials who do not vote their way, and ultimately, Wayne says, serves to create greater separation between citizens and their elected officials. He says this is not consistent with the founders' vision of a Republican form of government. Wayne says your guest is quite right when he says our system is broken. So he's agreeing with you, John Rao. John Samples, what do you think about Wayne's point?
Well, as we talked at the top of the hour, as I was mentioning, what we're talking about, the Speech Now case and super PACs and so on, and Citizens United to establish the principle, is you're not talking about lobbyists. You're talking about the super PACs that are non-lobbying in that way. The other alternative is this talk about retaliation is a pretty normal kind of a claim here. But I think we, in a sense, the question is, do you want government that is not, in fact, can do what it wants to? Unions or corporations or voters, think of the senior citizens lobby. In a sense, all what they ultimately have is a way of trying to constrain government and trying to get it more or less doing and public officials what they want. Now, if you look at the actual lobbying process, and when people look at it, political scientists, what you find is not a system dominated either by unions, corporations. You find a wide variety of interest groups, and I think that is probably not going to be changed by what is in the end outside money. That's the other thing that we've mentioned many times here is this is outside money as if there's something wrong with that. Well, remember, sometimes the problems are with the insiders, and if you don't have outside money, you don't have a way of sort of bringing up these issues that are being ignored by the insiders.
What do you think, John?
I think Wayne's 100% right, and so do the American people. A poll done by Washington Post ABC recently showed that 80% of the American people, bipartisan, 76% of Republicans, 85% of Democrats, oppose Citizens United. A poll we did here, Laura, in New Hampshire in October, when asked the question, how do you feel about Citizens United, 74% of New Hampshire primary presidential primary voters, Republicans and Democrats exactly the same, disagree with Citizens United. So what we're seeing now is a number of constitutional amendments being introduced into Congress. I think right now there's probably in work maybe 14 or 16 constitutional amendments. Bernie Sanders has one, and Congressman Conyers has one, et cetera. Normally, a constitutional amendment goes nowhere. We only have 27 of them, you know, and thousands get introduced. But if you think of the polls and how upset the public is about this special interest money, the Citizens United decision, I don't think it's out of the question that if the Congress happened, and it takes two-thirds votes of the House and Senate, to put a constitutional amendment in front of the state legislature, it could happen. My guess is it'll never get out of the House and the Senate with a two-thirds requirement. But the public's ready for real reform. Let there be no doubt about it. We've been polling for a long time. I've never seen a public so discouraged, as Wayne points out, about this private political system.
Well, and pardon me for being cynical, John Rao, but here's the question. Every time a campaign finance reform bill is passed or law is passed, people find ways around it. I mean, you know, it's like you squeeze the balloon in one area, it pops out in the other. We've seen this time and time again, loopholes, lawsuits, and so forth. So at some point, you know, are you wasting your time?
Absolutely not. We're not talking about restricting spending one inch, so there's no loopholes to look for. I agree with your point. With the regulations that restrict, that's exactly what happened. We're not restricting at all. We're cherishing speech. We're saying that candidates who run, try to qualify for voluntary public funding will ultimately get funds, the citizens giving up to $100 first, then those being matched 5-to-1 in the current bill. We're cherishing speech by uplifting the opportunity for candidates who wouldn't have the opportunity to run to have the resources. We're not talking about restricting at all. Let the money flow, but let's be sure that those candidates who go for public funding have sufficient so the voters can make their choice.
Well, and John Samples, is there a middle ground between you and John Rao, your two issues, concerns, free speech, too much money, not enough money? Is there a middle ground here?
Well, let me address the public opinion, because that actually looks like a pretty important issue and has actually been a consistent one. My view of this is twofold. One is it's always been found for the last 50 years since mass public opinion polling started, that the disturbing thing found around 1955 was that in the abstract, people do support the Bill of Rights. If you ask them, do you support the First Amendment, 95% yes. Do you support a communist speaking down in the public sphere? Well, maybe 30% support that, maybe 45%. The problem that we have here, and the reason we have a court system and a constitution, is in fact, as John said, from both sides of the political spectrum, people in fact do not support in concrete freedom of speech, and that's why you get these kinds of results. The other thing I would say about it is that while there is a little controversy about this that John may want to mention, but I don't think so. I think the major trend in the public opinion literature over a long period of time was that while you would get 60-40 support for campaign finance reform, you get roughly 60-40 opposition to public financing. People do not like to be taxed for supporting political campaigns that they don't particularly like either, and they sort of express that. And I think that's why you find, along with incumbent advantage and incumbent protection, why public financing doesn't get through.
John, super quick.
The New Hampshire poll that we ran in October, public funding or private funding, described which you prefer. The Republicans who planted to vote in the presidential Republican primary, 2-1 public over private. I think there's been a dramatic change in public attitudes.
All right. Well, gentlemen, we'll have to revisit this again. I got to close it out now. John Rau, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Laura, and thank you, John. Good to be with you.
John Rau is founder and CEO of Americans for Campaign Finance Reform. And John Samples, thank you also for your time. We appreciate it.
Always very informative and useful, Laura. Thanks.
John Samples, director of the Center for Representative Government at the Cato Institute and author of The Struggle to Limit Government. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Ryan Lassard. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange is now on Facebook. Join our page to continue the conversation. Learn more about what we're doing every day. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.